at her watch. 10 to 2. Still no train. She put her chin on the windowsill. She could feel the grey gristle of the felt that cushioned the window glass pressing into her chin skin. She took off her sunglasses to get a better look at the dead frog squashed on the road. It was so dead and squashed so flat that it looked more like a frog-shaped stain on the road than a frog. Rahel wondered if Miss Mitten had been squashed into a Miss Mitten-shaped stain by the milk truck that killed her. With the certitude of a true believer, Velipapan had assured the twins that there was no such thing in the world as a black cat. He said that there were only black cat-shaped holes in the universe. There were so many stains on the road. Squashed Miss Mitten-shaped stains in the universe. Squashed frog-shaped stains in the universe. Squashed crows that had tried to eat the squashed frog-shaped stains in the universe. Squashed dogs that ate the squashed crow-shaped stains in the universe. Feathers, mangoes, spit, all the way to Cochin. The sun shone through the Plymouth window directly down at Rahel. She closed her eyes and shone back at it. Even behind her eyelids, the light was bright and hot. The sky was orange, and the coconut trees were sea anemones waving their tentacles, hoping to trap and eat an unsuspecting cloud. A transparent spotted snake with a forked tongue floated across the sky. Then a transparent Roman soldier on a spotted horse. The strange thing about Roman soldiers in the comics, according to Rahel, was the amount of trouble they took over their armor and their helmets, and then after all that, they left their legs bare. It didn't make any sense at all, weather-wise or otherwise. Amu had told them the story of Julius Caesar and how he was stabbed by Brutus, his best friend, in the Senate, and how he fell to the floor with knives in his back and said, "Et tu, Brute? Then fall, Caesar." "It just goes to show," Amu said, "that you can't trust anybody, mother, father, brother, husband, best friend, nobody." With children, she said, when they asked, it remained to be seen. She said it was entirely possible, for instance, that Esther could grow up to be a male chauvinist pig. At night, Esther would stand on his bed with his sheet wrapped around him and say, "Et tu, Brute? Then fall, Caesar," and crash into bed without bending his knees, like a stabbed corpse. Cochimaria, who slept on the floor on a mat, said that she would complain to Mamachi. "Tell your mother to take you to your father's house," she said. "There you can break as many beds as you like. These aren't your beds. This isn't your house." Esther would rise from the dead, stand on his bed and say, "Et tu, Cochimaria? Then fall, Esther," and die again. Cochimaria was sure that "et tu" was an obscenity in English, and was waiting for a suitable opportunity to complain about Esther to Mamachi. The woman in the neighboring car had biscuit crumbs on her mouth. Her husband lit a bent after-biscuit cigarette. He exhaled two tusks of smoke through his nostrils, and for a fleeting moment looked like a wild boar. Mrs. Boar asked Rahel her name in a baby voice. Rahel ignored her and blew an inadvertent spit bubble. Amu hated them blowing spit bubbles. She said it reminded her of Baba, their father. She said that he used to blow spit bubbles and shiver his leg. According to Amu, only clerks behaved like that, not aristocrats. Aristocrats were people who didn't blow spit bubbles or shiver their legs, or gobble. Though Baba wasn't a clerk, Amu said he often behaved like one. When they were alone, Esther and Rahel sometimes pretended that they were clerks. They would blow spit bubbles and shiver their legs and gobble like turkeys. They remembered their father, whom they had known between wars. He once gave them puffs from his cigarette and got annoyed because they had sucked it and wet the filter with spit. "It's not a ruddy sweet," he said, genuinely angry. They remembered his anger. and Ammu's. They remembered being pushed around a room once, from Ammu to Baba to Ammu to Baba like billiard balls. Ammu pushing Esther away, "Here, you keep one of them. I can't look after them both." Later, when Esther asked Ammu about that, she hugged him and said he mustn't imagine things. In the only photograph they had seen of him, which Ammu allowed them to look at once, he was wearing a white shirt and glasses. He looked like a handsome, studious cricketer. With one arm, he held Esther on his shoulders. Esther was smiling, with his chin resting on his father's head. Rahel was held against his body with his other arm. She looked grumpy and bad-tempered, with her baby legs dangling. Someone had painted rosy blobs onto their cheeks. Ammu said that he had only carried them for the photograph, and even then had been so drunk that she was scared he'd drop them. Ammu said she'd been standing just outside the photograph, ready to catch them if he did. Still, except for their cheeks, Esther and Rahel thought it was a nice photograph. "Will you stop that?" Ammu said, so loudly that Muralidharan, who had hopped off the milestone to stare into the Plymouth, backed off, his stumps jerking in alarm. "What?" Rahel said, but knew immediately what. Her spit bubble. "Sorry, Ammu," Rahel said. "Sorry doesn't make a dead man alive," Esther said. "Oh, come on," Chako said. "You can't dictate what she does with her own spit." "Mind your own business," Ammu snapped. "It brings back memories," Esther, in his wisdom, explained to Chako. Rahel put on her sunglasses. The world became angry-colored. "Take off those ridiculous glasses," Ammu said. Rahel took off her ridiculous glasses. "It's fascist, the way you deal with them," Chako said. "Even children have some rights, for God's sake." "Don't use the name of the Lord in vain," Baby Kuchma said. "I'm not," Chako said. "I'm using it for a very good reason." "Stop posing as the children's great savior," Ammu said. "When it comes down to brass tacks, you don't give a damn about them. Or me." "Should I?" Chako said. "Are they my responsibility?" He said that Ammu and Esther and Rahel were millstones around his neck. The backs of Rahel's legs went wet and sweaty. Her skin slipped on the foam leather upholstery of the car seat. She and Esther knew about millstones. In Mutiny on the Bounty, when people died at sea, they were wrapped in white sheets and thrown overboard with millstones around their necks so that the corpses wouldn't float. Esther wasn't sure how they decided how many millstones to take with them before they set off on their voyage. Esther put his head in his lap. His puff was spoiled. A distant train rumble seeped upwards from the frog-stained road. The yam leaves on either side of the railway track began to nod in mass consent. "Yes, yes, 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 yes." The bald pilgrims in Beenamore began to sing another bhajan. "I tell you, these Hindus," Baby Kuchma said piously, "they have no sense of privacy." "They have horns and scaly skins," Chako said sarcastically. "And I've heard that their babies hatch from eggs." Rahel had two bumps on her forehead that Esther said would grow into horns. At least one of them would, because she was half Hindu. She had been quick enough to ask him about his horns, because whatever she was, he was too. The train slammed past under a column of dense black smoke. There were 32 bogies, and the doorways were full of young men with helmety haircuts who were on their way to the edge of the world to see what happened to the people who fell off. Those of them who craned too far fell off the edge themselves, into the flailing darkness. Their haircuts turned inside out. The train was gone so quickly that it was hard to imagine that everybody had waited so long for so little. The yam leaves continued to nod long after the train had gone, as though they agreed with it entirely and had no doubts at all. A gossamer blanket of coal dust floated down like a dirty blessing and gently smothered the traffic. Chako started the Plymouth. Baby Kuchma tried to be jolly. She started a song. There's a sad sort of clanging from the clock in the hall and the bells in the steeple, too. And up in the nursery, an absurd little bird is popping out to say. She looked at Esther and Rahel, waiting for them to say, "Cuckoo." They didn't. A car breeze blew. Green trees and telephone poles flew past the windows. Steel birds slid by on moving wires like unclaimed baggage at the airport. A pale day moon hung hugely in the sky and went where they went, as big as the belly of a beer-drinking man. Chapter 3. Big Man the Lalteen, Small Man the Mombati. Filth had laid siege to the Imanam house, like a medieval army advancing on an enemy castle. It clotted every crevice and clung to the window panes. Midges whizzed in teapots. Dead insects lay in empty vases. The floor was sticky. White walls had turned an uneven grey. Brass hinges and door handles were dull and greasy to the touch. Infrequently used plug points were clogged with grime. Light bulbs had a film of oil on them. The only things that shone were the giant cockroaches that scurried around like varnished gophers on a film set. Baby Kachma had stopped noticing these things long ago. Kocha Maria, who noticed everything, had stopped caring. The chaise longue on which Baby Kachma reclined had crushed peanut shells stuffed into the crevices of its rotting upholstery. In an unconscious gesture of television-enforced democracy, mistress and servant both scrabbled unseeingly in the same bowl of nuts. Kocha Maria tossed nuts into her mouth. Baby Kachma placed them decorously in hers. On The Best of Donahue, the studio audience watched a clip from a film in which a black busker was singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in a subway station. He sang sincerely, as though he really believed the words of the song. Baby Kachma sang with him, her thin, quavering voice thickened with peanut paste. She smiled as the lyrics came back to her. Kocha Maria looked at her as though she had gone mad and grabbed more than her fair share of nuts. The busker threw his head back when he hit the high notes, the where of somewhere, and the ridged pink roof of his mouth filled the television screen. He was as ragged as a rock star, but his missing teeth and the unhealthy pallor of his skin spoke eloquently of a life of privation and despair. He had to stop singing each time a train arrived or left, which was often. Then the lights went up in the studio, and Donahue presented the man himself, who, on a prearranged cue, started the song from exactly the point that he had had to stop, for a train, cleverly achieving a touching victory of song over subway. The next time the busker was interrupted mid-song was only when Phil Donahue put his arm around him and said, thank you very much. Being interrupted by Phil Donahue was, of course, entirely different from being interrupted by a subway rumble. It was a pleasure, an honor. The studio audience clapped and looked compassionate. The busker glowed with prime-time happiness, and for a few moments, deprivation took a back seat. It had been his dream to sing on the Donahue show, he said, not realizing that he had just been robbed of that, too. There are big dreams and little ones. Big man the Lalteen Sahib, small man the Mombati, an old coolie who met Esther's school excursion party at the railway station, unfailingly, year after year, used to say of dreams, big man, the lantern, small man, the tallow stick. Huge man, the strobe lights, he omitted to say, and small man, the subway station. The masters would haggle with him as he trudged behind them with the boys' luggage, his bowed legs further bowed, cruel schoolboys imitating his gait. Balls in brackets, they used to call him. Smallest man, the varicose veins, he clean forgot to mention, as he wobbled off with less than half the money he had asked for and less than a tenth of what he deserved. Outside, the rain had stopped, The grey sky curdled, and the clouds resolved themselves into little lumps, like substandard mattress stuffing. Estepan appeared at the kitchen door, wet and wiser than he really was. Behind him, the long grass sparkled. The puppy stood on the steps beside him. Raindrops slid across the curved bottom of the rusted gutter on the edge of the roof, like shining beads on an abacus. Baby Kuchma looked up from the television. "Here he comes," she announced to Rahel, not bothering to lower her voice. "Now watch, he won't say anything. He'll walk straight to his room, just watch." The puppy seized the opportunity and tried to stage a combined entry. Kuchmaria hit the floor fiercely with her palms and said, "Hup, hup, bona patti!" So the puppy wisely desisted. It appeared to be familiar with this routine. "Watch," Baby Kuchma said. She seemed excited. "He'll walk straight to his room and wash his clothes. He's very overclean. He won't say a word." She had the air of a game warden pointing out an animal in the grass, taking pride in her ability to predict its movements, her superior knowledge of its habits and predilections. Esther's hair was plastered down in clumps, like the inverted petals of a flower. Slivers of white scalp shone through. Rivulets of water ran down his face and neck. He walked to his room. A gloating halo appeared around Baby Kuchma's head. "See?" she said. Kuchmaria used the opportunity to switch channels and watch a bit of Prime Bodies. Rahel followed Esther to his room. Amu's room. Once. The room had kept his secrets. It gave nothing away. Not in the disarray of rumpled sheets, nor the untidiness of a kicked-off shoe, or a wet towel hung over the back of a chair, or a half-read book. It was like a room in a hospital after the nurse had just been. The floor was clean, the walls white, the cupboard closed, shoes arranged, the dustbin empty. The obsessive cleanliness of the room was the only positive sign of volition from Esther, the only faint suggestion that he had, perhaps, some design for life. Just the whisper of an unwillingness to subsist on scraps offered by others. On the wall by the window, an iron stood on an ironing board. A pile of folded, crumpled clothes waited to be ironed. Silence hung in the air like secret loss. The terrible ghosts of impossible-to-forget toys clustered on the blades of the ceiling fan. A catapult. A Qantas koala from Miss Mitten with loosened button eyes. An inflatable goose that had been burst with a policeman's cigarette. Two ballpoint pens with silent streetscapes and red London buses that floated up and down in them. Esther put on the tap and water drummed into a plastic bucket. He undressed in the gleaming bathroom. He stepped out of his sodden jeans, stiff, dark blue, difficult to get out of. He pulled his crushed strawberry t-shirt over his head, smooth, slim, muscular arms crossed over his body. He didn't hear his sister at the door. Rahel watched his stomach suck inwards and his ribcage rise, as his wet t-shirt peeled away from his skin, leaving it wet and honey-colored. His face and neck and a V-shaped triangle at the base of his throat were darker than the rest of him. His arms, too, were double-colored, paler where his shirt sleeves ended. A dark brown man in pale honey clothes, chocolate with a twist of coffee, high cheekbones and hunted eyes. A fisherman in a white-tiled bathroom with sea secrets in his eyes. Had he seen her? Was he really mad? Did he know that she was there? They had never been shy of each other's bodies, but they had never been old enough, together, to know what shyness was. Now they were. Old enough. Old. A viable, dieable age. What a funny word, old was on its own, Rahel thought, and said it to herself. Old. Rahel at the bathroom door. Slim-hipped. Tell her she'll need a cesarean, a drunk gynecologist had said to her husband while they waited for their change at the gas station. A lizard on a map on her faded t-shirt. Long wild hair with a glint of deep henna red sent unruly fingers down into the small of her back. The diamond in her nostril flashed. Sometimes, and sometimes not. A thin gold serpent-headed bangle glowed like a circle of orange light around her wrist. Slim snakes whispering to each other, head to head. Her mother's melted wedding ring. Down softened the sharp lines of her thin, angular arms. At first glance, she appeared to have grown into the skin of her mother. High cheekbones. Deep dimples when she smiled. But she was longer, harder, flatter, more angular than Amu had been. Less lovely, perhaps, to those who like roundness and softness in women. Only her eyes were incontestably more beautiful. Large, luminous, drownable in, as Larry McCaslin had said, and discovered to his cost. Rahel searched her brother's nakedness for signs of herself, in the shape of his knees, the arch of his instep, the slope of his shoulders, the angle at which the rest of his arm met his elbow, the way his toenails tipped upwards at the ends. The sculpted hollows on either side of his taut, beautiful buns. Tight plums. Men's bums never grow up. Like school satchels, they evoke, in an instant, memories of childhood. Two vaccination marks on his arm gleamed like coins. Hers were on her thigh. Girls always have them on their thighs, Amu used to say. Rahel watched Esther with the curiosity of a mother watching her wet child, a sister, a brother, a woman, a man, a twin, a twin. She flew these several kites at once. He was a naked stranger, met in a chance encounter. He was the one that she had known before life began. The one who had once led her swimming through their lovely mother's cunt. Both things unbearable in their polarity. In their irreconcilable far apartness. A raindrop glistened on the end of Esther's earlobe, thick, silver in the light, like a heavy bead of mercury. She reached out, touched it, took it away. Esther didn't look at her. He retreated into further stillness, as though his body had the power to snatch its senses inwards, knotted, egg-shaped, away from the surface of his skin, into some deeper, more inaccessible recess. The silence gathered its skirts and slid, like Spider-Woman, up the slippery bathroom wall. Esther put his wet clothes in a bucket and began to wash them with crumbling, bright blue soap. Chapter 4. Abhilash Talkies. Abhilash Talkies advertised itself as the first cinema hall in Kerala with a 70mm CinemaScope screen. To drive home the point, its facade had been designed as a cement replica of a curved CinemaScope screen. On top, cement writing, neon lighting, it said, Abhilash Talkies, in English and Malayalam. The toilets were called His and Hers. Hers for Amu, Rahel, and Baby Kuchuma. His for Esther alone, because Chako had gone to see about the bookings at the Hotel Sea Queen. Will you be okay? Amu said, worried. Esther nodded. Through the red formica door that closed slowly on its own, Rahel followed Amu and Baby Kuchuma into hers. She turned to wave across the slippery, oily marble floor at Esther alone, with a comb, in his beige and pointy shoes. Esther waited in the dirty marble lobby with the lonely, watching mirrors till the red door took his sister away. Then he turned and padded off to his. In hers, Amu suggested that Rahel balance in the air to piss. She said that public pots were dirty, like money was. You never knew who touched it. Lepers, butchers, car mechanics, pus, blood, grease. Once, when Cochimaria took her to the butcher's shop, Rahel noticed that the green 5-rupee note that he gave them had a tiny blob of red meat on it. Cochimaria wiped the blob away with her thumb. The juice left a red smear. She put the money into her bodice. Meat-smelling blood money. Rahel was too short to balance in the air above the pot, so Amu and baby Kochma held her up, her legs hooked over their arms, her feet pigeon-toed in bata sandals. High in the air, with her knickers down. For a moment, nothing happened, and Rahel looked up at her mother and baby grandaunt with naughty, now what, question marks in her eyes. Come on, Amu said. For the sound of susu. For the sound of music. Rahel giggled. Amu giggled. Baby Kochma giggled. When the trickle started, they adjusted her aerial position. Rahel was unembarrassed. She finished, and Amu had the toilet paper. Shall you or shall I? Baby Kochma said to Amu. Either way, Amu said. Go ahead, you. Rahel held her handbag. Baby Kochma lifted her rumpled sari. Rahel studied her baby grandaunt's enormous legs. Years later, during a history lesson being read out in school, the Emperor Barber had a wheatish complexion and pillar-like thighs. This scene would flash before her, baby Kochma, balanced like a big bird over a public pot. Blue veins like lumpy knitting running up her translucent shins, fat knees dimpled, hair on them. Poor little tiny feet to carry such a load. Baby Kochma waited for half a moment, head thrust forward, silly smile, bosom swinging low, melons in a blouse, bottom up and out. When the gurgling, bubbling sound came, she listened with her eyes. A yellow brook burbled through a mountain path. Rahel liked all this, holding the handbag, everyone pissing in front of everyone, like friends. She knew nothing then of how precious a feeling this was, like friends. They would never be together like this again, Amu, baby Kochma, and she. When baby Kochma finished, Rahel looked at her watch. So long you took, baby Kochma, she said. It's 10 to 2. Rub-a-dub-dub, Rahel thought. 3 women in a tub. Tarry a while, said Slow. She thought of Slow being a person. Slow Kurian. Slow Kuti. Slow Mall. Slow Kochama. Slow Kuti, Fast Vergis and Kuriakos. 3 brothers with dandruff. Amu did hers in a whisper, against the side of the pot so you couldn't hear. Her father's hardness had left her eyes, and they were Amu eyes again. She had deep dimples in her smile and didn't seem angry anymore, about Velitha or the spit bubble. That was a good sign. Esther alone in his had to piss into naphthalene balls and cigarette stubs in the urinal. To piss in the pot would be defeat. To piss in the urinal, he was too short. He needed height. He searched for height, and in a corner of his, he found it. A dirty broom, a squash bottle half full of a milky liquid, phenol, with floaty black things in it, a limp floor swab, and 2 rusty tin cans of nothing. They could have been Paradise pickle products, pineapple chunks in syrup, or slices, pineapple slices. His honor redeemed by his grandmother's cans, Esther alone organized the rusty cans of nothing in front of the urinal. He stood on them, 1 foot on each, and pissed carefully, with minimal wobble, like a man. The cigarette stubs, soggy then, were wet now, and swirly, hard to light, When he finished, Esther moved the cans to the basin in front of the mirror. He washed his hands and wet his hair. Then, dwarfed by the size of Amu's comb that was too big for him, he reconstructed his puff carefully, slicked back, then pushed forward and swiveled sideways at the very end. He returned the comb to his pocket, stepped off the tins, and put them back with the bottle and swab and broom. He bowed to them all. The whole shooting match. The bottle, the broom, the cans, the limp floor swab. "Bow," he said, and smiled, because when he was younger, he had been under the impression that you had to say bow when you bowed, that you had to say it to do it. "Bow, Esther," they'd say, and he'd bow and say, "Bow," and they'd look at each other and laugh, and he'd worry. Esther alone, of the uneven teeth. Outside, he waited for his mother, his sister, and his baby grandaunt. When they came out, Amu said, "Okay, Estherpen?" Esther said, "Okay," and shook his head carefully to preserve his puff. "Okay? Okay." He put the comb back into her handbag. Amu felt a sudden clutch of love for her reserved, dignified little son in his beige and pointy shoes, who had just completed his first adult assignment. She ran loving fingers through his hair. She spoiled his puff. The man with the steel, ever-ready torch said that the picture had started, so to hurry. They had to rush up the red steps with the old red carpet. Red staircase, with red spit stains in the red corner. The man with the torch scrunched up his munda and held it tucked under his balls in his left hand. As he climbed, his calf muscles hardened under his climbing skin like hairy cannonballs. He held the torch in his right hand. He hurried with his mind. "It started long ago," he said. So they'd missed the beginning, missed the rippled velvet curtain going up, with light bulbs in the clustered yellow tassels. Slowly up, and the music would have been "Baby Elephant Walk" from Hatari, or "Colonel Bogey's March." Amu held Esther's hand. Baby Kochma, heaving up the steps, held Rahel's. Baby Kochma, weighed down by her melons, would not admit to herself that she was looking forward to the picture. She preferred to feel that she was only doing it for the children's sake. In her mind, she kept an organized, careful account of things she'd done for people and things people hadn't done for her. She liked the early nun bits best and hoped they hadn't missed them. Amu explained to Esther and Rahel that people always loved best what they identified most with. Rahel supposed she identified most with Christopher Plummer, who acted as Baron von Trapp. Charco didn't identify with him at all and called him Baron von Claptrap. Rahel was like an excited mosquito on a leash, flying, weightless. Up two steps, down two, up one. She climbed five flights of red stairs for Baby Kuchma's one. "I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, dum-dum. I live in a caravan, dum-dum. I open the door and fall on the floor. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man, dum-dum." Up two, down two, up one, jump-jump. "Rahel," Amu said, "you haven't learned your lesson yet, have you?" Rahel had. "Excitement always leads to tears, dum-dum." They arrived at the Princess Circle lobby. They walked past the refreshments counter where the orange drinks were waiting, and the lemon drinks were waiting, the orange too orange, the lemon too lemon, the chocolates too melty. The torchman opened the heavy Princess Circle door into the fan-whirring, peanut-crunching darkness. It smelled of breathing people and hair oil and old carpets. A magical Sound of Music smell that Rahel remembered and treasured. Smells like music hold memories. She breathed deep and bottled it up for posterity. Esther had the tickets, little man. He lived in a caravan, dum-dum. The torchman shone his light on the pink tickets, row J, Numbers 17, 18, 19, 20. Esther, Amu, Rahel, Baby Kachma. They squeezed past irritated people who moved their legs this way and that to make space. The seats of the chairs had to be pulled down. Baby Kachma held Rahel's seat down while she climbed on. She wasn't heavy enough, so the chair folded her into itself like sandwich stuffing, and she watched from between her knees. Two knees and a fountain. Esther, with more dignity than that, sat on the edge of his chair. The shadows of the fans were on the sides of the screen where the picture wasn't. Off with the torch, on with the world hit. The camera soared up in the sky-blue, car-colored Austrian sky with the clear, sad sound of church bells. Far below, on the ground, in the courtyard of the abbey, the cobblestones were shining. Nuns walked across it, like slow cigars. Quiet nuns clustered quietly around their reverend mother, who never read their letters. They gathered like ants around a crumb of toast. Cigars around a queen cigar. No hair on their knees. No melons in their blouses. And their breath like peppermint. They had complaints to make to their reverend mother. Sweet singing complaints about Julie Andrews, who was still up in the hills, singing "The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music," and was once again late for Mass. She climbs a tree and scrapes her knee, the nun sneaked musically. Her dress has got a tear. She waltzes on her way to Mass and whistles on the stair. People in the audience were turning around. "Shh," they said. "Shh, shh, shh." And underneath her wimple, she has curlers in her hair. There was a voice from outside the picture. It was clear and true, cutting through the fan-whirring, peanut-crunching darkness. There was a nun in the audience. Heads twisted around like bottle caps. Black-haired backs of heads became faces with mouths and mustaches, hissing mouths with teeth like sharks, many of them like stickers on a card. "Shh," they said together. It was Esther who was singing, a nun with a puff, an Elvis Pelvis nun. He couldn't help it. "Get him out of here," the audience said when they found him. "Shut up or get out. Get out or shut up." The audience was a big man. Esther was a little man with the tickets. "Esther, for heaven's sake, shut up," Amu's fierce whisper said. So Esther shut up. The mouths and mustaches turned away. But then without warning, the song came back and Esther couldn't stop it. "Amu, can I go and sing it outside?" Esther said, before Amu smacked him. "I'll come back after the song." "But don't ever expect me to bring you out again," Amu said. "You're embarrassing all of us." But Esther couldn't help it. He got up to go, past angry Amu, past Rahel concentrating through her knees, past Baby Kachma, past the audience that had to move its legs again this way and that. The red sign over the door said "Exit" in a red light. Esther exited. In the lobby, the orange drinks were waiting. The lemon drinks were waiting. The melty chocolates were waiting. The electric blue foam leather car sofas were waiting. The coming soon posters were waiting. Esther alone sat on the electric blue foam leather car sofa in the Abilash Talkies Princess Circle lobby and sang. In a nun's voice, as clear as clean water. "But how do you make her stay and listen to all you say?" The man behind the refreshments counter, who'd been asleep on a row of stools waiting for the interval, woke up. He saw, with gummy eyes, Esther alone in his beige and pointy shoes and his spoiled puff. The man wiped his marble counter with a dirt-colored rag, and he waited, and waiting, he wiped. And wiping, he waited and watched Esther sing. How do you keep a wave upon the sand? Oh, how do you solve a problem like Maria?
"Hey, Racherka,"
the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said in a gravelly voice, thick with sleep. What the hell do you think you're doing? How do you hold a moonbeam in your hand? Esther sang.
Hey, the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said. Look, this is my resting time. Soon I'll have to wake up and work, so I can't have you singing English songs here. Stop it.
His gold wristwatch was almost hidden by his curly forearm hair. His gold chain was almost hidden by his chest hair. His white, terraline shirt was unbuttoned to where the swell of his belly began. He looked like an unfriendly, jeweled bear. Behind him there were mirrors for people to look at themselves in while they bought cold drinks and refreshments, to reorganize their puffs and settle their buns. The mirrors watched Esther.
I could file a written complaint against you, the man said to Esther. How would you like that? A written complaint?
Esther stopped singing and got up to go back in.
Now that I'm up, the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said, now that you've woken me up from my resting time, now that you've disturbed me, at least come and have a drink. It's the least you can do.
He had an unshaven, jowly face. His teeth, like yellow piano keys, watched little Elvis the pelvis. No, thank you, Elvis said politely. My family will be expecting me, and I've finished my pocket money.
Pocket money?
The Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said, with his teeth still watching. First English songs, and now pocket money. Where do you live, on the moon? Esther turned to go.
Wait a minute, the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said sharply.
Just a minute, he said again more gently.
I thought I asked you a question.
His yellow teeth were magnets. They saw, they smiled, they sang, they smelled, they moved. They mesmerized.
I asked you where you lived, he said, spinning his nasty web.
Imanum, Esther said. I live in Imanum. My grandmother owns Paradise Pickles and Preserves. She's the sleeping partner.
Is she now? The Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said. And who does she sleep with?
He laughed a nasty laugh that Esther couldn't understand.
Never mind, you wouldn't understand. Come and have a drink, he said. A free cold drink. Come. Come here and tell me all about your grandmother.
Esther went, drawn by yellow teeth.
Here, behind the counter, the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said.
He dropped his voice to a whisper.
It has to be a secret because drinks are not allowed before the interval. It's a theater offense.
Cognizable, he added after a pause. Esther went behind the refreshments counter for his free cold drink. He saw the three high stools arranged in a row for the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man to sleep on, the wood shiny from his sitting.
Now, if you'll kindly hold this for me, the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said, handing Esther his penis through his soft white muslin dhoti, I'll get you your drink. Orange, lemon?
Esther held it because he had to.
Orange, lemon, the man said. Lemon orange?
Lemon, please, Esther said politely. He got a cold bottle and a straw. So he held a bottle in one hand and a penis in the other, hard, hot, veiny, not a moonbeam. The Orange Drink Lemon Drink man's hand closed over Esther's. His thumbnail was long like a woman's. He moved Esther's hand up and down, first slowly, then fastly. The lemon drink was cold and sweet, the penis hot and hard. The piano keys were watching.
So your grandmother runs a factory? The Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said. What kind of factory?
Many products, Esther said, not looking, with the straw in his mouth. Squashes, pickles, jams, curry powders, pineapple slices.
Good, the Orange Drink Lemon Drink man said. Excellent.
His hand closed tighter over Esther's, tight and sweaty, and faster still. Fast, faster, fest. Never let it rest, until the faster's faster and the faster's fest. Through the soggy paper straw, almost flattened with spit and fear, the liquid lemon sweetness rose. Blowing through the straw while his other hand moved,
Esther blew bubbles into the bottle, sticky sweet lemon bubbles of the drink he couldn't drink. In his head, he listed his grandmother's produce. Pickles, mango, green pepper, bitter gourd, garlic, salted lime. Squashes, orange, grape, pineapple, mango. Jams, banana, mixed fruit, grapefruit marmalade. Then the gristly, bristly face contorted and Esther's hand was wet and hot and sticky. It had egg white on it. White egg white. Quarter boiled. The lemon drink was cold and sweet. The penis was soft and shriveled like an empty leather change purse. With his dirt-colored rag, the man wiped Esther's other hand. "Now finish your drink," he said, and affectionately squished a cheek of Esther's bottom. Tight plums in drain pipes. And beige pointy shoes. "You mustn't waste it," he said. "Think of all the poor people who have nothing to eat or drink. You're a lucky rich boy with pocket money and a grandmother's factory to inherit. You should thank God that you have no worries. Now finish your drink." And so, behind the refreshments counter, in the Abhilash Talkies Princess Circle lobby, in the hall with Kerala's first 70mm cinemascope screen, Esther Pinyako finished his free bottle of fizzed, lemon-flavored fear. His lemon, too cold, too sweet. The fizz came up his nose. He would be given another bottle soon, free fizzed fear. But he didn't know that yet. He held his sticky, other hand away from his body. It wasn't supposed to touch anything. When Esther finished his drink, the orange drink lemon drink man said, "Finished? Good boy." He took the empty bottle and the flattened straw and sent Esther back into the Sound of Music. Back inside the hair oil darkness, Esther held his other hand carefully, upwards, as though he was holding an imagined orange. He slid past the audience, their legs moving this way and that, past baby Kochma, past Rahel, still tilted back, past Amu, still annoyed. Esther sat down, still holding his sticky orange. And there was Baron von Claptrap, Christopher Plummer, arrogant, hard-hearted, with a mouth like a slit, and a steel-shrill police whistle. A captain with 7 children. Clean children, like a packet of peppermints. He pretended not to love them, but he did. He loved them. He loved her, Julie Andrews. She loved him. They loved the children loved them. They all loved each other. They were clean, white children, and their beds were soft with eider-downs. The house they lived in had a lake and gardens, a wide staircase, white doors and windows, and curtains with flowers. The clean white children, even the big ones, were scared of the thunder. To comfort them, Julie Andrews put them all into her clean bed and sang them a clean song about a few of her favorite things. These were a few of her favorite things. 1. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes. 2. Wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. 3. Bright copper kettles. 4. Doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles. 5. Etc. And then, in the minds of certain two-egg twin members of the audience in Abhilash Talkies, some questions arose that needed answers. A. Did Baron von Claptrap shiver his leg? He did not. B. Did Baron von Claptrap blow spit bubbles? Did he? He did most certainly not. C. Did he gobble? He did not. Oh, Baron von Trapp, Baron von Trapp, could you love the little fellow with the orange in the smelly auditorium? He's just held the orange drink, lemon drink man Susu in his hand, but could you love him still? And his twin sister, tilting upwards with her fountain in A Love in Tokyo, could you love her too? Baron von Trapp has some questions of his own. A. Are they clean, white children? No. But Sophie Moll is. B. Do they blow spit bubbles? Yes. But Sophie Moll doesn't. C. Do they shiver their legs, like clerks?
Yes, but Sophie Moll doesn't.
D. Have they either or both ever held strangers' susus?
Yes, but Sophie Moll hasn't.
Then I'm sorry, Baron von Claptrap said. It's out of the question. I cannot love them. I cannot be their Baba. Oh, no. Baron von Claptrap couldn't.
Esther put his head in his lap.
What's the matter? Amu said. If you're sulking again, I'm taking you straight home. Sit up, please, and watch. That's what you've been brought here for.
Finish the drink. Watch the picture. Think of all the poor people. Lucky rich boy with pocket money. No worries.
Esther sat up and watched. His stomach heaved. He had a green, wavy, thick, watery, lumpy, seaweedy, floaty, bottomless, bottomful feeling.
Amu, he said.
Now what?
The what snapped, barked, spat out.
Feeling vomity, Esther said. Just feeling, or do you want to? Amu's voice was worried.
Don't know.
Shall we go and try? Amu said. It'll make you feel better.
Okay, Esther said.
Okay? Okay. Where are you going? Baby Gutman wanted to know.
Esther's going to try and vomit, Amu said. Where are you going? Rahel asked.
Feeling vomity, Esther said. Can I come and watch?
No, Amu said.
Past the audience again, legs this way and that. Last time to sing, this time to try and vomit. Exit through the exit.
Outside in the marble lobby, the orange drink lemon drink man was eating a sweet. His cheek was bulging with a moving sweet. He made soft sucking sounds like water draining from a basin. There was a green Paris wrapper on the counter. Sweets were free for this man. He had a row of free sweets in dim bottles. He wiped the marble counter with his dirt-colored rag that he held in his hairy watch hand. When he saw the luminous woman with polished shoulders and the little boy, a shadow slipped across his face. Then he smiled, his portable piano smile.
"Out again so soon?" he said.
Esther was already retching. Amu moonwalked him to the Princess Circle bathroom, hers. He was held up, wedged between the not-clean basin and Amu's body, legs dangling. The basin had steel taps and rust stains, and a brown-webbed mesh of hairline cracks, like the roadmap of some great, intricate city. Esther convulsed, but nothing came, just thoughts. And they floated out and floated back in. Amu couldn't see them. They hovered, like storm clouds over the basin city. But the basin men and basin women went about their usual basin business. Basin cars and basin buses still whizzed around. Basin life went on.
No, Amu said.
No, Esther said.
No?
No.
Then wash your face, Amu said. Water always helps. Wash your face, and let's go and have a fizzy lemon drink.
Esther washed his face and hands and face and hands. His eyelashes were wet and bunched together. The orange drink lemon drink man folded the green sweet wrapper and fixed the fold with his painted thumbnail. He stunned a fly with a rolled magazine. Delicately, he flicked it over the edge of the counter onto the floor. It lay on its back and waved its feeble legs.
Sweet boy this, he said to Amu. Sings nicely.
He's my son, Amu said.
Really? The orange drink lemon drink man said and looked at Amu with his teeth. Really? You don't look old enough.
He's not feeling well, Amu said. I thought a cold drink would make him feel better.
Of course, the man said. Of course, of course. Orange lemon, lemon orange.
Dreadful, dreaded question.
No, thank you, Esther looked at Amu, green wavy, seaweedy, bottomless, bottomful.
What about you? The orange drink, lemon drink man asked Amu. Coca-Cola, Fanta, ice cream, rose milk?
No, not for me, thank you, Amu said. Deep, dimpled, luminous woman.
Here, the man said with a fistful of sweets, like a generous air hostess. These are for your little mon.
No, thank you, Esther said, looking at Amu.
Take them, Esther, Amu said. Don't be rude.
Esther took them. Say thank you, Amu said.
Thank you, Esther said. For the sweets, for the white egg white.
No mention, the orange drink lemon drink man said in English.
So, he said, Morn says you're from Imanam.
Yes, Amu said.
I come there often, the orange drink lemon drink man said. My wife's people are Imanam people. I know where your factory is. Paradise Pickles, isn't it? He told me, your Morn.
He knew where to find Esther. That was what he was trying to say.
It was a warning. Amu saw her son's bright, fever-button eyes.
We must go, she said. Mustn't risk a fever. Their cousin is coming tomorrow, she explained to Uncle. And then added casually, from London.
From London?
A new respect gleamed in Uncle's eyes, for a family with London connections.
Esther, you stay here with Uncle. I'll get baby Kuchma and Rahel, Amu said.
Come, Uncle said.
Come and sit with me on a high stool.
No, Amu. No, Amu, no. I want to come with you.
Amu, surprised at the unusually shrill insistence from her usually quiet son, apologized to the orange drink, lemon drink uncle. He's not usually like this. Come on then, Esther Pin.
The back inside smell, fan shadows, backs of heads, necks, collars, hair, buns, plaits, ponytails. A fountain in a love in Tokyo. A little girl and an ex-nun. Baron Von Trapp's 7 peppermint children had had their peppermint baths and were standing in a peppermint line with their hair slicked down, singing in obedient peppermint voices to the woman the Baron nearly married, the blonde Baroness who shone like a diamond. The hills are alive with the sound of music.
We have to go, Amu said to baby Kuchma and Rahel.
But Amu, Rahel said, the main things haven't even happened yet. He hasn't even kissed her. He hasn't even torn down the Hitler flag yet. They haven't even been betrayed by Rolf the postman.
Esther's sick, Amu said. Come on.
The Nazi soldiers haven't even come.
Come on, Amu said. Get up.
They haven't even done High on a Hill Lived a Lonely Goat Herd.
Esther has to be well for Sophie Moll, doesn't he? Baby Kuchma said.
He doesn't, Rahil said, but mostly to herself.
What did you say?
Baby Kuchma said, getting the general drift, but not what was actually said.
Nothing, Rahil said. I heard you, Baby Kuchma said.
Outside, Uncle was reorganizing his dim bottles, wiping with his dirt-colored rag the ring-shaped water stains they had left on his marble refreshments counter, preparing for the interval. He was a clean orange drink, lemon drink uncle. He had an air hostess's heart trapped in a bear's body.
Going then? He said.
Yes, Amu said. Where can we get a taxi?
Out the gate, up the road, on your left, he said, looking at Rahel. You never told me you had a little mall, too.
And holding out another sweet. Here, mall, for you.
Take mine, Esther said quickly, not wanting Rahel to go near the man.
But Rahel had already started towards him. As she approached him, he smiled at her. And something about that portable piano smile, something about the steady gaze in which he held her, made her shrink from him. It was the most hideous thing she had ever seen. She spun around to look at Esther. She backed away from the hairy man. Esther pressed his parry sweets into her hand, and she felt his fever-hot fingers whose tips were as cold as death.
Bye, Mon, Uncle said to Esther. I'll see you in Imanam sometime.
So the red steps once again. This time, Rahel lagging, slow. No, I don't want to go. A ton of bricks on a leash.
Sweet chap, that orange drink, lemon drink fellow, Amu said.
Chee, baby Kuchma said.
He doesn't look it, but he was surprisingly sweet with Esther, Amu said.
So why don't you marry him then, Rahel said petulantly.
Time stopped on the red staircase. Esther stopped. Baby Kuchma stopped.
Rahel, Amu said.
Rahel froze.
She was desperately sorry for what she had said. She didn't know where those words had come from. She didn't know that she'd had them in her. But they were out now and wouldn't go back in. They hung about that red staircase like clerks in a government office. Some stood, some sat, and shivered.